As you heard, we got a text late yesterday that Richard wasn't feeling well, so we had to do some scrambling. And so what you get is a little bit of what I've been studying recently, part of what some thoughts provoked by Richard's sermon on Veterans Day. I'd like to welcome any guests we have here. Of course, Richard is a normal preacher, and we have a number of men that help fill in various times. So I'm here this morning. One of the things I want to look at is there's a Greek word that's used 101 times in the New Testament, kalos, or kalos, which means good, and in some cases beautiful, good, a good quality of or good disposition. It also can be fertile or rich, useful, profitable. It is well, excellent, choice, select, goodly. It is pleasant, delightful, just, full measure, honorable, distinguished, good, possessing moral excellence, worthy, upright, virtuous, what is good and right, a good deed, and rectitude, which I had to look up, morally correct behavior or thinking, righteousness, virtue, right duty, propriety, benefit, favor. Now, you think of that. What are some of the things, what are the things that you would label as good, beautiful, pleasant, or delightful? And you may say, I've had a good life. You may have, or State Farm claims to be, you know, your good neighbors. Since this week, we might have talked about a good meal or a good game. We greet people and say good day or good night. And most of the time in the Bible, that's consistent to what we understand. You know, we talk about a tree bearing good fruit. The healthy tree bears good fruit. In the parable of the sower, there's good soil. We talk about good works that shine before others, or and have good conduct. And Jesus' signs and wonders, he says, are good works from the Father. The parable and the illustration of the salt is good unless it's trampled underfoot. Jesus, in his first miracle, made good wine as opposed to the poor wine that people usually serve when everybody's drunk and can't tell the difference anyway. There's the good shepherd. In Titus 2, verse 7, it says, show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. 1 Peter talks about honorable conduct, which is another way to translate that. Or the good servant of Jesus Christ. Timothy talks about good doctrine. That we should be able, in Hebrews 5:14, talks about being able to distinguish between good from evil. Hebrews 6:3 talks about tasted the goodness of the word of God. And Hebrews 10, familiar passage, let us consider how to stir one another to love and good works. And we like the promise of Luke 6:38. Give and it'll be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. We put into our lap with the measure you use it will be the measure back to you. All right, and that's kind of appropriate even as we just gave of our offering. But then we get to 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 18. You all want to turn there with me? Verse Paul writes to Timothy in one of the last letters that he pens and says, "This charge I entrust to you, Timothy, my child, in accordance with the prophecies previously made about you, that by them you may wage the good warfare." We don't usually consider good warfare to be in the same sentence as what we call an oxymoron, like jumbo shrimp or the living dead, cruel kindness, military intelligence, or software works, or Microsoft works, you know. But he says, wage the good warfare. And the two words before that, the charge that I entrusted you, both of those words start with para, which is what we get parallel from, sitting beside. The charge is used five times. It says a command, order, charge, direction, precept. And that can also be used in a military context. And parathetemi is to place by the side of or near, to set before, to deposit, to commit a charge of, and trust and commend. So this is not a light thing that Paul is telling Timothy, but he says, I charge you, or I give you or entrust you with this charge to wage the good warfare. And the wage there is actually a military word, the strategiomai. We get the word strategy from. Or I remember as a kid there was a game that we played, a board game called Strategio, where you try to take over each other's territory by knocking down each other's players. And the warfare is also this similar word with the strategia, is a military expedition and campaign, or can be used to refer to general military service. Excuse me. And the strategiomai is also used in 2 Timothy 3. Or the word kalos is also used there again. 2 Timothy 2:3 says, share in suffering as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. And generally, we don't associate suffering with good either. But, you know, he's saying, you know, share in that suffering as a good soldier. So strategies is a soldier. And later in 2 Timothy 4:7, Paul says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. And that's probably his last letter that he ever penned before his death. So we got good soldier, good warfare, good fight. And they seem kind of out of character. So how is warfare good? What makes the war good or the fight good? Generally, we think about the horrors of war. What a lot of men, especially men historically, have seen. Usually they don't talk about it to their family. I had four uncles that all served in World War II, two Marines in the Pacific, and Air Force and an Army. In fact, one of my uncles, the only one in the Army, was in a POW camp in Europe. And the stories that, of course, they bring back can haunt them. And, you know, we know today about PTSD. In the past, they call it shell shock. But the impact that war has, and historically in battle, you had a whole lot higher chance of dying from diphtheria or other disease than you would be from a gunshot, because people don't normally like to shoot other human beings. So why is it so important for Paul to address this in his last letters? And if we go back to 1 Timothy 1, 19, if you may still be there. He finishes that sentence. He says, holding faith and good conscience. By rejecting this, some have made a shipwreck of their faith. And of course, then he mentions two that have abandoned the teachings and have handed over to Satan because they're blaspheming. So the good warfare, he says, is holding faith and having a good conscience. The holding there is to seize or possess or have ready, to be affected by, to be subjected to hold, esteem, regard. To have or hold as an object of knowledge, faith, or practice. And so holding our faith and sticking to the faith is a component of this good warfare. The other thing he mentions is a good conscience. And that's, even though in the English usually it's translated good like the other one, it's actually a different Greek word, which means generous, upright, or virtuous. And it's this good conscience is also listed as one of the qualifications for a servant or deacon, to hold the mystery of faith with a clear conscience, as is written in 1 Timothy 3:9. So fighting well, of course, one of the things of studying the Bible is any passage you read, you ought to understand the context it was written. And if we look earlier in the verses, earlier in the letter, like 1 Timothy 1, verses 3 to 11, he says, charge certain persons not to teach any different doctrine, nor to devote themselves to myths or endless genealogies, which promote speculations, rather than the stewardship that God, that is by faith, stewardship from God that is by faith. The aim of our charge is love that issues from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. So you, again, you get the good conscience, and in this case, he says sincere faith. Certain persons, by swerving from these, have wandered away into vain discussions, desiring to be teachers of the law, without understanding either what they are saying or the things about which they make confident assertions. So he's saying that people can act as they are convinced of things being a certain way, but deviate from the truth that was set apart by the apostles. The fact that you could swerve from the path and wander away implies that there is the way. There is a way. And after this verse in 1 Timothy 6, 20 to 21, he says, O Timothy, guard the deposit entrusted to you. Avoid the irreverent babble and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge, for by professing it, some have swerved from the faith. And of course, one of the things that they're dealing with this at this time is what's called Gnosticism, which comes from Gnosis and knowing. And there's this perception that somehow I can know and think that I'm righteous and it doesn't matter what I do with my body or what sins I commit, that the spirit is separate from the body. And so what these passages show is that there is false knowledge and people will swerve from the truth, from the faith, wander away and engage in vain discussions. And Paul's charge to Timothy is make sure that he fights that good warfare to keep those concepts true. In 2 Corinthians 10, 4 through 8, these same words are used in two parallel passages that are similar, and as I said, in chapter 10, verses 4 and 5. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds, and we destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, And take every thought captive to obey Christ, being ready to punish every disobedience when your obedience is complete. When your obedience is complete. And if you're in the class earlier that Wes taught, he talked about, don't mess with the plan, right? God set apart his message. He made sure he had given it to trusty people who passed it on and recorded it and saved it for us that we may know what his desire is for our lives. And and this passage again uses a lot of military terms. The warfare, destroy strongholds, being against something, to be held captive. Those things are associated with warfare as well. And the passage that we had read in Jude, verse 3, Jude writes, "Beloved, although I was very eager to write to you about our common salvation, I found it necessary to write and appealing to you to contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints." So it was delivered once, it doesn't change. But man will try to accumulate teachers that please them, those that have itching ears. And so you are in the good warfare. Or should I say it another way, are you in the good warfare? Are you a good soldier? In Paul's second letter to Timothy, we find a similar discussion of battle. If you turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 2, the context, verses 1 and 2, but also 3 and 4. So, "You then, my child, be strengthened in the grace that is in Jesus Christ, and what you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, and trust to faithful men who are able to teach others also. Share in suffering as a good soldier in Christ," which we mentioned earlier. So the good soldier, the kalos, stratiotes, good soldier of Jesus Christ. And verse 4 says, "No soldier gets entangled in civilian pursuits, since his aim is to please the one who enlisted him." And there are several words there that are very powerful. Again, the concept of soldier in verse 4, but there's this word entangled. Implico is to intertwine. Actually, there's the similar Greek word which means the braiding of the hair, the weaving the hair together, is what its root is from, which is to implicate, entangle, involve, to be implicated, involved, or entangle oneself in. And what are they entangling or shouldn't entangle themselves in is the civilian affairs or the pragmatia. And we talk about pragmatics as in English. And this is an application to a matter of business or business affair or transaction or business pursuits. So we're mixing military service with business pursuits. And that is what Paul says a good soldier doesn't do. He says a good soldier, since his aim is to please the one who enlists him, the aim there is bios, which we get biology from. It's the biosphere. It's the living. And there's a lot of meaning in that word. It's life. It's your purpose. The meaning for living, not just living itself. The sustenance, the maintenance, the substance, the good, the property, and possessions are all part of that bios. And that's dedicated and focused on serving the one who enlisted you into his army. And that word is to please, or resko, is to please, to be pleasing, to seek favor with, or to consult the pleasure of anyone. And again, this last word, the one who enlisted him, comes back again to this military term, stratologio, so strategy and logistics. It's to collect or gather an army, to enlist troops, to enroll or to recruit. So this good warfare is pretty prominent and pretty important for Paul to bring this up in his remaining, you know, the last letters of his life. And so the challenge for us is, you were enlisted as a Christian to be a fellow soldier of Christ, to contend for the faith that was once for all delivered. So the question is your whole aim, your purpose in life, your bios, your means of living, your possessions dedicated to God's mission? And in the military, we talk about things being GI. You know, I had GI Joes as a kid, right? GI is government issued. That means the stuff that you get doesn't belong to you, it belongs to the government. You know, so, and everything you got belongs to the government. But everything that we have is God issued. And it's for His purpose. And so, are you using those things for His purpose? Secondly, do you consult with or seek favor with the one who enlisted you into His army? Do you seek to please God, to imitate Christ in all that you do? So we need to be acting, knowing that God watches us, watches over us, knowing that there are many witnesses that root us on in the battle that we rage here on earth. And do you recognize that you have been enlisted? I mean, it's one thing to go into battle knowing that you're a soldier, knowing there's a potential to be hit. And a lot of, and I don't know if all services do this, but I think the Marines do this, when you're going, before you go into battle, you have to designate who the person will be that carries your body back home if you were to die on the battlefield. So you don't have to worry about that at a time. I mean, at that time. So you know that you're living for this battle, this success, this day, and not worried about the future that may not happen. So, you know, it's pretty sobering to try to figure out, well, who do I want to entrust my body, my remains for its flight home to the grave? So you have to recognize that you've been enlisted to fight the good fight, to wage the good warfare. And then we also, you know, do you put on the full armor of God each day, knowing the enemy is waiting to take as many as he can with him to hell, and to make hell for the rest of the faithful here on this earth? Fourthly, are you allowing the pragmatics of this life to entangle you? Is being sensible and realistic hindering your effectiveness? Is your Christianity more businesslike, more practical than it is as a warrior for the King, or as a relationship as a son or daughter of the Father? This is a family matter. You know, a lot of military people say, I'm not fighting because I hate those in front of me, but because I love those behind me. So you're out in the front between your enemy and those you love. And that's what your Christian life should be focused on as well. And fifthly, has the world and the things of this world gotten you so wound up that you confuse what is from the Father and what is from the deceiver? Do you confuse what was once for all delivered with myths and imaginations of men? And if you use the same word, the root there, that would there be enough evidence in your life to implicate you as a Christian, as a child of Christ, or would it be thrown out of court because there's not enough evidence to demonstrate your alliance to Christ? Can the people around you, especially those who are not saved, know and understand who you serve and which side you're on and which battle you're in? And so those are a few thoughts, hopefully some things to challenge you to think about. And as I have said in other sermons, you know, when you look around and so-called bad things happen to good people, sometimes that doesn't make sense until you realize if I'm in warfare and I'm on the battleground, you expect things to blow up. You expect things to go wrong. You expect people to be injured and hurt. And if that is your perception and you know that's happening and that there is an invisible battle around you between the forces of good and the forces of evil, then those bad things aren't as surprising. And you, unfortunately, Satan tries to get us to blame God when bad things happen. But his gifts were all good, and we chose to disobey. You know, Satan will try to blame God. And we can even see that in the struggle of Job in his life. And luckily, Job, he had some faults, but he didn't reject God. And when he started to question God, he thought better of it. And we need to do the same. So if there's any chance that or any impact that you've had or any questions this morning, we'd like to help you in any way we can, either through prayers or if you aren't in the battle, we need to work on getting you on the battle line. If you're not yet a Christian, we can help you do that as well. Please come forward as we have a chance to sing during the song.
Join in a song with sweet accord. Join in a song with sweet accord.